Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, democracy has eroded in the United States. What are the causes of the erosion and what can be done to stop it? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. For several years, democracy has faced challenges in the United States. The 2020 election and the transition process following the election, which led to one of the major political parties rejecting the outcomes of the election and attempting an overthrow of it, has highlighted these challenges that American democracy faces. On today's show, we will explore the threats and challenges to democracy and ask, is American democracy at risk? If so, what must be done to address and redress some of these threats? Our panel today is Jacob Hacker, Stanley Reeser Professor of Political Science at Yale University. He's the co-author of American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper, and a 2010 bestseller, Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. And his co-author is Paul Pearson. Sigal Ben-Purath, a professor of education in the Education Division of the Graduate School at the University of Pennsylvania. She also holds a secondary appointment in the Department of Political Science and is the author of Free Speech on Campus and Citizenship Under Fire, Democratic Education in Times of Conflict. Martin Gillens, chair of the Department of Public Policy and professor of public policy, political science, and social welfare at UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs. He's the author of Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America, and the co-author with Benjamin Page of Democracy in America, What Has Gone Wrong and What Can We Do About It? And Larry Bartels, the May Worthen Shane Chair of Public Policy and Social Science at Vanderbilt University. He's the co-director of the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. He's the co-author of Democracy for Realists, Why Elections Do Not Produce Responsive Government with Christopher Atchin, and Unequal Democracy, the Political Economy of the New Gilded Age. Thank you all very much for joining us. Jacob Hacker, let's start with you. The big question for today, is American democracy actually eroding, or is this just a perception of erosion?
No, I think it actually is eroding. And the evidence for that is right in what you said at the outset, right? We have a major political party that is pushing the false claim that the election in 2020 was stolen. But I think the problems that our democracy faces go much deeper than the recent series of events that we all know about. Over the last generation, as Marty has written, you know, we've seen rising inequality, and Larry's written about this too. And that inequality has put strains on our political system. But I think perhaps most important, we've seen rising polarization. And it's not just on party lines, but those party lines are very much associated with racial and ethnic lines and also lines of education. And so our political system was set up around an ideal, never realized, of a kind of nonpartisan problem-solving political elite. And what we have now is a very polarized political elite and a polarized public. And our political system has a hard time dealing with that. And I would just add one other thing, which I think is most evident in recent years, and particularly in recent Republican efforts to try to undermine electoral democracy at the state level. And that is that our political institutions have also generally not tilted very much in favor of one party or another. But these same institutions that aren't very good at dealing with polarization are really bad at dealing with a situation in which one party has a kind of systematic advantage. And the Republicans, mostly because they have really strong presence in non-urban areas, for a variety of reasons, that really accentuates their power in our political system. The Republican Party has also kind of pushed the advantages it has to the very limits and beyond those limits. And so I think that's why we're in such a perilous spot for democracy today.
And Sigal Ben-Purath, Jacob had focused somewhat on political elites, although, you know, polarization is both at the elite level and down, you know, at the voter level. Now, your focus has been on education. How much is this erosion of democracy really kind of from the bottom up?
Thank you. Yes. So I would say that we can see democratic backsliding also at the broader level of the population. And some of the aspects that Jake mentioned are actually evident in, you know, in the general population as well, polarization as well as affective polarization, meaning just how we feel about each other across party lines. We have very different perceptions of truth and how to find it and how to use evidence in order to make sure that our claims are accurate, whether about the elections, as Jake mentioned, or about COVID or about other matters, right? So what are our sources of information? This is another thing that really divides us and I think generates or at least enhances democratic backsliding. Because I'm in education, I have to say something optimistic. It's part of my job description. And so I'm going to mention one way in which democracy actually is in a promising spot. And that has to do with increased engagement, particularly among young people. And so we do see increased interest as well as increased knowledge about politics and about public matters among young people, early voters, and also people before the voting age. So it's pretty clear that even though we have a lot of things to work on, and even though many politicians, because of reasons such as the one that were already mentioned, many politicians are looking to reshape and limit the ways in which young people can be engaged, can learn about democracy, the kind of subject that they may talk about. And I'm happy to talk about that later if you want. But despite all of these challenges, young people are significantly more engaged in politics. And this is promising for our democratic future.
Oh, absolutely. And Martin Gillens, I know you've written about questions about responsiveness on the part of government. And one of the critiques that we've heard, not just in the United States, but actually across a number of democratic governments and the potential for erosion, has been the government's inability to respond to economic dislocations, to, you know, modern capitalism, to globalization. Is the erosion of American democracy the result of a government that, frankly, has not been terribly effective and perhaps incapable of dealing with some of the real core issues that drive voters?
I think that's exactly on target. You know, I would understand the erosion of American democracy on kind of two levels. And one is sort of longer term lack of effectiveness, lack of government responsiveness to the needs of sort of ordinary citizens that you just alluded to. And then that has contributed to the sort of more immediate challenges that we've seen that Jacob had talked about in terms of, you know, lack of commitment to democratic norms, efforts to undermine those norms and procedures, to overturn elections when you don't like the results, attacks on voting rights, and so on, that have really kind of accelerated in the last few years, and especially, of course, with Trump's, you know, candidacy and then presidency. But you're absolutely right that those are sort of layered on top of a much longer, sort of decades long decline in sort of the satisfaction of the public with the government, and a very, you know, well-grounded dissatisfaction in as much as government policy has shifted towards the needs and the preferences of the wealthy and of organized interest groups and away from the needs and the preferences of ordinary Americans.
So Larry Bartels, I know you've written about sort of democracy perceived as the interests of individuals, individual voters versus interest groups or our social identities. I know one of the critiques about the erosion of American democracy is that it has been focused on too much identity politics. It's certainly conservative, a rightist critique of this erosion. But from your writing, I would gather that you would disagree that the erosion is because of identity politics versus the American people. So, but how much is this question about social identities and the way in which we organize ourselves central to American democracy?
Democracy means a lot of different things. And so I think it's useful to try to differentiate what we're talking about. One kind of simple-minded indicator is mass participation in the political process. And on that score, I would say, you know, people are more worked up. Turnout in elections has been much higher recently than it had been for a long time. And so in some sense, by those indicators, democracy is in good shape right now in the US. But obviously, in other respects, it's not. The concern about whether election outcomes will actually be honored is a really important concern. I think it's mostly a concern at the elite level, although the willingness of lots of ordinary citizens to engage in that kind of thinking and behavior is important as well. And there, I think identity politics is an important part of what's going on. If you think about why it is that people are seemingly willing to set aside democratic procedures and democratic values, the first thing I would say is there's a lot of that all the time in mass publics, especially. Often we don't see it because those aren't live issues in the political debate at most times in recent American history, at least. But insofar as people are sufficiently agitated to be willing to be tempted by anti-democratic initiatives or movements, I think the fundamental reason is that there are a lot of people who are reacting very aversely to really radical, significant social change in the US over the last 50 years. I think that's really the heart of political polarization and the heart of our political problems at that level. If democracy means responsiveness to the will of ordinary citizens, then I would say with Marty, you know, that's a problem. We have a lot of evidence suggesting that there isn't much of that going on. I think I differ from Marty in thinking that that's a change in the contemporary system. I think it's probably would be hard to identify any time or place in which democracy has functioned well in that respect. One of the really interesting things that's gone on, building on his work and others over the last decade, is that people have studied patterns of responsiveness to the policy preferences of ordinary citizens in lots of other seemingly advanced affluent democracies and found very similar disparities in responsiveness to affluent and middle class and poor people, which suggests that the explanation probably doesn't have to do with the details of American institutions or the campaign finance system or the biases in the Senate or the Electoral College, but rather more fundamental issues with how democracy works and how economic power gets translated into political power.
Martin Gillins, I can't help but, you know, hear what Larry just said and thought about, you know, descriptions of late stage capitalism. You're talking about questions of economic dislocations, the centralization of power among certain economic elites, and, you know, so the big broad question about political elites versus the responsiveness to a general population. So I guess at one level, I know people have, one person in particular has predicted this type of outcome. Is this more of a crisis of capitalism and governance within capitalism, or is it really at the core a government that have gathered too much power over the course of history and just haven't been as responsive to the needs of poor populations, working class and middle class even, which is kind of natural for capitalism, these dislocations and particularly this globalized capitalism?
Well, that's a really big question. I do think that there are sort of global developments within capitalism and technology and trade and so on, which do put sort of pressures on all democratic countries, but they've responded, different countries have responded in different ways. And the US is kind of an extreme in responding to these pressures in ways that actually exacerbate inequality and sort of worsen the economic prospects of poor and middle class people. I think part of that, going back to what Larry was just saying, is that American elites, US elites, do have different sort of views, more laissez-faire views, more views that are sort of less conducive to government policies that help to ameliorate some of the pressure, inequality pressures that globalization and technological change and so on create. But part of it may well have to do with the structures of our government and the sort of vicious cycle that increasing economic inequality leads to increasing political inequality, which then exacerbates those economic inequalities as wealthy interests are pursuing their own political preferences. So I think there are these sort of broader phenomena, but layered on top of that are the specific responses of individual political systems and voters in different countries.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing democratic erosion and the future of democracy in America with Jacob Hacker of Yale University, Sigal Ben-Parath of the University of Pennsylvania, Martin Gillens of UCLA, and Larry Bartels of Vanderbilt University. And Jacob Hacker, you had highlighted polarization as one of the real, key causes of this erosion, which left me asking, is the polarization a tactic on the part of political elites? What we're finding, there's both institutional reasons, but sort of broad power-centric reasons, why leaders are polarizing. There's fundraising that's tied into questions of polarization. The perception that's where you get the votes is to mobilize your base, and that comes from polarization. So do we have an incentive structure that incentivizes polarization in the United States? And that as a potential cause of this erosion?
Well, pretty clearly, if you watch American politics today, we do have strong incentives for continued polarization. I want to place my answer in the context of these points that Marty and Larry made about the U.S. in comparative perspective, because one thing I think it's worth emphasizing is that both the rise of inequality and the degree to which the U.S. is marked by starkly unequal outcomes, where the very richest have pulled away from the rest of Americans, and the extent of demographic change through both the fact that we were quite a diverse country a generation ago, and that we've seen massive immigration over this period, both of those things have been much more intense in the United States than in other rich democracies. And we are a country that's on the verge of becoming what's often called a majority-minority nation. We'll be the first, if we make it through this transition, the first, multiracial democracy of that sort that's made that transition. And then that's taking place in this context of extreme inequality. So I think we really need to understand that, the U.S. context is different and the U.S. institutional structure is different. So I remember when I was a kid, I used to watch, Saturday morning cartoons, and there was this public service announcement that showed a frying pan. And it showed an egg. It said, "This is your brain." And then it showed a frying pan. And then you drop the egg in the frying pan. It said, "This is your brain on drugs." And when you think about the January 6th insurrection or the 2020 election big lie, that's in many ways our political system on asymmetric polarization, right? Like when you have polarization of the sort we have today, where it's extreme and it's driven by the increasing radicalism of one party, the Republican Party, you get the kinds of, I think, the kinds of sort of norm breaking, outrage stoking and ultimately potentially democracy breaking behavior that we've been seeing over the last decade, but particularly in the last few years. And so, I would just go back and say, I agree with Marty and Larry, and that there are a bunch of different ways in which we can understand democratic decline, but to a degree that I couldn't have anticipated a decade ago, we're really facing a kind of, a real threat to the stability of democracy itself. And I think that has to do with the mismatch between this extreme polarization along demographic lines and, driven in part by rising inequality and our political institutions.
Sigal, you've done quite a bit of research in democracy in this comparative context. What are some of your thoughts on the state of these questions we've been raising?
Thank you. So I would say, particularly in the American context and following on Jake's comments, I think one way in which institutionally we are continuing to exacerbate inequalities is really in the access to opportunity that schools provide to people from diverse class and ethnicity and race backgrounds. And so one of the ways in which polarization is exacerbated, first of all, institutionally, is by the fact that the close to 90% of American students who attend public schools attend very different public schools. And so they are put on very different trajectories, which continue to sustain the unequal opportunities that are available to them, and therefore continue to feed the mistrust and the sense of unresponsiveness that a lot of people in the public feel or correctly feel. And the other thing is that in terms of our political opinions, schools are increasingly, as the main public institutions that are available and open and familiar to young people as they grow in this country, schools are increasingly silencing students with the blessing of the courts, right? And so young people do not benefit or enjoy from the rights of open expression within these institutions because the courts have significantly limited their opportunities to engage in an open exchange of ideas. And therefore, they don't learn how to engage with each other across difference. Hence, it is made much more easy to politicians to just use the incentive structure that you mentioned and really build on the capacity to enrage and to radicalize their bases because people are not used to hearing diverse opinions and to exchange their views with others with whom they are familiar. And this really is something that is happening in other countries as well, in Europe to some extent, in Israel, where I'm from and where I did some of my work in different ways. But it is uniquely an American phenomenon where public schools are really open to the vast majority of the population, but they are so unequal that they really do not create the kind of level playing field from which we are all starting out as equal citizens. And I think this is one of the main things that we need to address. And unfortunately, right now, most of the legislative efforts are actually going in the opposite direction.
When you talk about the silencing of students and the silencing of discourse, one of the striking things, Sigal, is that both sides are accusing the schools of silencing. Certainly the rights arguments that they have been silenced, talking about the way in which teachers, faculty will indoctrinate students, and of course, contemporary news, thinking of issues like the attempt at banning something called critical race theory, the banning of certain books, you know, the banning of the book Mouse from a school board in Tennessee, et cetera. So I guess the question here is, I mean, how is it possible that everybody's voice is being banned? The right is upset that the left is banning them. The left is upset that the right is banning them. How do we get out of this seeming cycle?
Well, similarly to the comments about American politics more broadly, I don't think that this is in effect something that's happening on both sides in equal measures, right? If you look at the legislative efforts in 40 states at the moment, at different stages of legislation, we see exclusively conservative and Republican efforts to limit expression in schools. We see exclusively conservative efforts to attempt to ban or sometimes just simply take out of libraries books about race, about gender and sexuality, and about other matters that are deemed to be either uncomfortable or controversial, including books about MLK, books about Ruby Bridges. So really not books that you would think are seen as inflammatory. And so how do we get out of that? Well, I think we organize and push back, right, at the local level. I mean, with education, really the main effort that can be done is at the local level with parents, citizens, and oftentimes students organizing to engage as citizens in sharing their views and their concerns. We see now increasingly both parent circles and teen circles that are discussing books that have been banned in their particular districts. And so some of these efforts really show what I was trying to say initially, which is that youth engagement specifically and civic engagement more broadly or political engagement is really on the rise. And this is the one optimistic note that I can sound here, because of course, legislatively, politically, institutionally, and structurally, we are facing significant challenges.
And Larry Bartels, right? I mean, when you think about the discourse about silencing voices, silencing discourse, et cetera, again, it seems to circle back to this question about identity versus, you know, kind of American civic education or American, you know, civic culture. I guess one of the real challenges here is there's a lot of people participating, which sounds more democratic, but we're concerned about the erosion of democratic norms. What is the best way to address that reality? I don't think what we're saying is we need more people to participate. We might be saying we need fewer people to participate, or at least figure out a way to elevate the discourse where we're focused on democratic norms, or at least the participation as a way to reinforce democratic norms, rather than some of the participation that we're seeing now, which is decidedly challenging those norms. What's the best way to try to promote that?
One of my favorite political thinkers is Arthur Bentley. And one of his insights was that politics is always a power struggle, and it's convenient and sometimes a reasonably good approximation to imagine that that struggle is going to go on through the electoral process. But people's attachment to the electoral process itself in the abstract or to that family of democratic values is never all that strong. And when their fundamental identities and interests are challenged, or at least when they perceive them to be challenged, they're going to do whatever they can find to try to protect themselves. At the extreme, engaging in political violence, but stepping back a few steps from that, engaging in political behavior that we think of as being illegitimate or outside the bounds of normal politics. And for those of us who don't feel like our fundamental values are being challenged, that's illegitimate and frightening, and we condemn it, but we probably should not be surprised by it.
Martin Gillins, you had a response to the comments we had had, you know, previous to this. Please.
Just wanted to respond to what Larry had said, which I partially agree with and partially disagree with. So where I agree is I don't think that probably there's been any place in time where the vast majority of citizens have had a strong enough commitment to democratic norms to override the kinds of other concerns that Larry mentioned when they're, you know, sort of what they view as their fundamental interests and values are at stake. Having said that, I do think that, you know, not only are politics, generally speaking, but especially the threats to democracy that we've seen recently are an elite-led phenomenon. And I think it's elites who are threatening our democracy, and it's elites who are going to have to play, I would argue, a more active role than they have already in order to, you know, sustain it from those threats. And, you know, I think it's a situation where it doesn't take a majority of the public to kind of abandon democracy for our institutions to be eroded or our sort of electoral processes to be undermined. It only takes a willingness of people to kind of look the other way, despite their preference for, you know, maintaining democracy, their, you know, belief in the Constitution as being of, you know, great value and so on. But if elites take the lead in undermining those processes, then I think that's really where the danger lies. And we see it perhaps because of the media environment that we live in, a lot of attention to not just elites, but sort of ordinary citizens. And surely there are, as we saw on January 6th, for example, plenty of ordinary citizens who are willing to, you know, kind of take up that banner of overturning elections and undermining, democratic norms. But nevertheless, there are a very small portion of the American public. And, you know, I just want to sort of provide that kind of perspective that this is not sort of a mass phenomenon of abandonment of democracy, but it may be elite driven within a context of a sort of lack of sufficient concern that ordinary citizens would balance their sort of democratic commitments against their other sorts of values that they have.
And Jacob Hacker made me think of this commentary about, is this the elites or is this a mass movement, et cetera? I think we would be remiss to not recognize that the Republican Party's current position, which certainly has been moving away from democratic norms, are really driven by its leadership. And a number of Republicans who are vying for that leadership are trying to navigate between a commitment to democratic norms and a need for a fealty to its former president that seems to be driving a great deal of this. So I guess the question is, how much of this really is the result of a campaign of Donald Trump? And if he is no longer the standard bearer from the Republican Party, would this threat, this elite-driven threat to democratic norms and principles really erode, really go away?
Well, I think you put your finger on it by saying that this is really, and Marty also said that this is really driven by elite strategies. That's not to say that there isn't a substantial share of Americans who strongly supported Donald Trump and believe that the election in 2020 was stolen despite all evidence. But we're talking about a minority of the electorate and thus, a real minority of the American population. But I think the three things I would really emphasize here is that the way our political institutions are structured, I think has created real, as I said at the outset, has created real problems in the context of this kind of asymmetric polarization. And Segal is right. This is not a both sides story. There's just a lot more discontent about the direction the country is going in terms of its increasing diversity and about and a lot more of a sense that the way democracy is working is illegitimate, at least at the electoral level on the right. And I just wouldn't, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the right-wing media, both, outlets like Fox News and social media are a big part of the story about how those kinds of beliefs can percolate and get more intense. There just is no counterpart to right-wing media on the left. So the three things that I think, the three features of our institutions I think really matter here are one, that in the context of polarization and particularly asymmetric polarization, it's really hard to govern, right? So Marty was totally right that there's just this discontent that the system isn't working, and that's longstanding. Trump, and in direct answer to your question, Trump is really a symptom of that sense of discontent. But then, of course, he's added greatly to the problem and brought a kind of more direct threat to our democracy in his behavior and both in and out of office. And then the two other things I would just mention are the Republican Party doesn't need a majority to hold and gain and hold power in our system because of the, as I said before, the system is tilted against urban or metro areas. The Senate has two senators per state. So Republicans have been able to repeatedly capture majorities in the Senate without a majority of votes in Senate elections in the country. Electoral college means that the president can be elected without a majority of the popular vote, and that's remarkably happened twice since 2000. And then I'll just mention something that I think is less recognized, but it's becoming more recognized, which is just that if you're an urban-oriented party like the Democratic Party, it's much easier for your opponents to gerrymander districts to concentrate voters, to reduce the sway of voters who metro vote, metro/urban voters. So as I said before, that's leading to this sort of third problem of cumulative partisan advantage that is self-reinforcing. And that's what we see, I think, now, using the very decentralized electoral system we have to change electoral laws, to restrict access to the ballot, or to more aggressively gerrymandering. there's also a cumulative partisan advantage in the Supreme Court, right? How do we have a 6-3 conservative majority when we have at best for Republicans, a 50-50 nation? Well, we have it because of the tilt of the Senate and because we've had two presidents elected since 2000 without a majority of the popular vote. So two Republican presidents. So I don't want to go on, but I just want to emphasize that I really do think we can't simplify this down to, is it voters or is it institutions? It's the interplay of voters and institutions through the way our party system works and the elite strategies that are emerging in this particular context.
And Martin Gillins, now what gets me thinking here is we have the perception in the United States that one political party is reformist, if not looking to have fairly drastic change, particularly on the economic level. In 2016, Donald Trump campaigned on some pretty dramatic changes economically. And the Democrats, the perception was that they were defending the current order and had to try to defend that position. It seemed to replay in 2020 that the Democrats were defending the current system, Republicans were attacking it, and certainly President Trump's attacks against the Democratic norms would be a weakness of that approach, but we still have the perception. Republicans want to reform your relationship with your job, your relationship, you know, government's responsiveness, and the Democrats seem to want to maintain that. So at one level, I guess this is a strategic question. Shouldn't the Democrats try to adopt a much more of an ideology that might question the relationship between government and the economy and those questions of elites? And secondly, just as a note, one is political rhetoric and one is reality. It's not that the Republican Party, even under Trump, had a fundamental alteration of the relationship between economic elites and the political system, but they did a pretty masterful job of projecting an image that they were.
I completely agree. You know, I think for all of Trump's failures and shortcomings, you know, he was masterful at tapping into some of these populist sort of themes, which have frankly been, you know, open for, you know, an open opportunity for both Democrats and Republicans. So, you know, ever since, well, I would say probably going back to Carter, but the Democrats have embraced a sort of neoliberal, free trade, deregulatory kind of agenda, which has worked, you know, pretty well for American businesses and not particularly well for ordinary Americans, for American workers. And we've seen that in sort of the nature of the trade policy that's been adopted, among other things. And Trump, you know, came in as the champion, in part, at least as the champion of, you know, workers and talking about, you know, reforming trade policy and so on. And of course, that's not what he did when he was in office. His, you know, major electoral achievement was quite a regressive tax policy, which was quite unpopular also. So I think there's a huge gap there between the reality and the rhetoric on certainly in Trump's position. And that was possible in part because he was an outsider to the Republican establishment. And he was able to sort of adopt policies, at least rhetorically, that went against traditional Republican positions, and that did have this kind of populist appeal. We could see the same thing on the left with Bernie Sanders and sort of progressive wing of the Democratic Party, which has adopted also the kind of more sort of progressive populist positions. You know, the system isn't working, we need to change it, you know, putting forward, you know, within the sort of existing system, at least more sort of dramatic assistance for citizens, whether it has to do with funding for education, you know, public education, or, you know, help for families, healthcare, and so on. And these have been traditional Democratic priorities. The American people tend to be much more supportive of those policies. But the truth is that Democrats haven't delivered nearly as much as, you know, their sort of the progressive wing's rhetoric, at least, would suggest. And, you know, that's for a variety of reasons, including some of the things that Jacob mentioned about the sort of systemic tilt toward the Republican Party, which has been like so evident in the Democrats' struggles since Biden came into office, where they have the very slim majority that can be undermined by even now one senator who opposes any legislation. So would the Democrats be better off, to sort of answer your question, if they'd adopted more of a position of we're going to reform the system in these fundamental ways? You know, it's hard to know. It could very well be. I mean, my view, I think I'm consistent with Larry's work here, is that the public has a good sense of what their values are, but not much of a sense of what kinds of policies would best advance those values. And if Democratic elites were to sort of effectively channel the sort of broad preferences of the majority of voters for, you know, a more egalitarian and a more sort of helpful and responsive government, would they be better off electorally? Maybe they would. It's hard to know.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the future of American democracy with Jacob Hacker of Yale University, Sigal Ben-Parath of the University of Pennsylvania, Martin Gillens of UCLA, and Larry Bartell of Vanderbilt University. And Larry, I guess, to that point too, how much has identity politics, racial politics, the culture war sorts of questions with respect to diversity, in the sense that as the Democrats attempted to reach out to economically marginalized populations, it was very quickly criticized by saying, well, you're reaching out to immigrant communities, maybe not quite as explicit, but it's certainly the undertone is you're reaching out to non-white communities, and ultimately this division of economically marginalized communities ended up breaking down electorally racially. So I guess we're back to the question about race and identity and the way to try to bridge that gap.
I think that's right. It's convenient for us as analysts to try to separate the domain of economic issues from social and cultural issues, but in most people's mind, they're intimately intertwined. And while there are some specific issues on which the public as a whole is well to the left of what government is actually doing, there are also issues where people, especially in the Republican Party, but not only in the Republican Party, are really distrustful of government efforts to try to improve their situation because they view the government as an engine for cultural change and as an agency to support, on one hand, the people that they view as the traditional elites, often meaning not economic elites, but cultural elites as they view them. And on the other hand, people that they view as undeserving in one way or another of government support. And so the issue of opportunity, the kind of concerns about the welfare system that Marty's written about, I think loom very large in how people think about these issues and how they respond to them. Overall, the Republican base is certainly still well to the right of the Democratic base and of the population as a whole. So I don't think we can explain Trump's success in terms of a kind of populist economic agenda.
Sigal, we've talked about different potential ways to think about the electorate, whether it be kind of a class or economically marginalized or some of the different cultural issues. You've highlighted the generational issue here. That's certainly the hope you're drawing on the future of democracy is coming from younger populations. And so I guess part of the question is it fair to describe that younger populations are just more committed to democracy, certainly are much more likely to be more to the left than older populations? And the way that's kind of played itself out, both with the political parties, and I also think about policy proposals like, should we spend money to ensure Medicare or for Social Security or the child tax credit versus writing off student debt? And so from a political perspective, how much is other generational differences really what's defining differences in the American electorate?
Well, I think there are clear generational differences in some of these matters. And I actually think they relate back to your question earlier about culture and identity and race. I think while it's not evident to me that younger generations are on a trajectory to be more progressive or, to have different partisan affiliations in the way that you describe, We oftentimes see people becoming more conservative as they age. And so the current generational difference is not something that I would necessarily bank on if I were, you know, running the Democratic platform for some odd reason. What I would say is that there is a clear difference in generational commitment to a diverse representation of voices, right? So there is way more tolerance and even more than that, acceptance and embracing of diverse perspectives among young populations. People are more willing to listen to others across racial and ethnic lines, across gender and sexuality lines, than people in older generations. And while this represents some rift sometimes in the culture wars or in the way campuses are represented, you know, often for political reasons, in my view, this is a very promising sign that these issues are actually going to ebb. They're not going to be as significant as these young people grow up, because I don't think people of the younger generation today will become less accepting of diverse identities as they grow. I think this is something that can stick even as other policy preferences or political affiliations can still evolve. And one other point, I don't think necessarily policies like Medicaid, et cetera, are going to be central to this process, but climate is actually going to be an important issue in the generational reconfiguring of acceptable policies. And so this, you know, these two issues, the issue of identity and the issue of climate, I think are represented much more significantly in the younger population. And, you know, it's hopeful for me. I don't know that it's necessarily hopeful from the broader democratic perspective, right? Because when you look at surveys, young people, you know, can be seen to have that, you know, a wide range of views about democratic principles, values, and institutions. And so you cannot necessarily say that they're going to be more committed to upholding core democratic values. I think they are questioning what are the core democratic values, what good are they for our generation, you know. And so I think these issues are going to remain under consideration for younger people, even as some of the identity and culture issues are going to evolve as they grow.
And Larry Bartels, you have a reaction.
Yeah, I think this generational perspective is a really important one to keep in mind as we think about where we are and where we're going. In a sense, the intensity of feeling on the right, I think, has a lot to do with the sense that they have that they're on the losing side of this long-term social and cultural change. And, you know, in international relations, people worry about managing declining powers and trying to get through those kinds of power transitions with as little threat of war and violence as possible. And I think we're really in the same kind of situation domestically, that we're trying to manage this huge social change in a way that provokes as little violence and disruption to the system as possible. But it's hard to doubt that the transition is coming. Jacob said at one point, you know, if we get through this one way or another, we're going to get through it, and we're going to be a very different country 30 years from now than we are now.
And Jacob, are you optimistic or pessimistic about where this is all going?
Well, I think that Astigal and Larry kind of showed the two sides of the picture really well. So my short-term picture is pretty bleak. I think we're given something we haven't mentioned at all, the continuing dislocations of the pandemic, and given the reality that incumbent presidents' parties get creamed in midterm elections. And I could add a bunch of other things that have dragged down the Democrats, most notably the one that Marty mentioned, which is it's extremely difficult for them to achieve some of their key priorities. And given all that, right, the short-term prognosis is not very good. And, you know, the changes that are taking place at the state level, we can overstate them, but they're not good for democracy either, right? Efforts to restrict access to the ballot and to reduce the likelihood that younger and non-white voters will be able to vote, and then efforts to gerrymander to try to hold on to power, even for Republicans to try to hold on to power, even when they're losing the population as a whole over time. So the way I think about it is kind of like we're in a dark tunnel and we see a light up ahead. And what we don't really know is whether that light is the end of the tunnel or a train barreling toward us. And I agree with Larry that in some sense we will find out and we will get through it, but it could be a lot more painful if it's a train of really serious Democratic backsliding barreling toward us. Let me say one thing that I think Segal said already, and I think it's really important, is that this we shouldn't overstate the degree to which this is in the hands of voters, but it is really important to recognize that a lot of this is happening at the local level, and that in addition, protests have a big effect on politics at the state, you know, all forms of participation, but protests has been shown to have a big impact at the state, local, and especially national level. And so I think it's really important to stay engaged with these issues and recognize that, you know, that there's a lot of value in our democracy and there's a lot of people who are concerned and that we really need to try to sort of get through this dark tunnel together. And that's what makes me hopeful, is the sense that we have ideas for how to solve some of these problems, as you know, Marty has written and Larry and Segal have all written about things we could do at the level of education and political reform and so on. But we're gonna have to work really hard to get there.
And Martin Gillens, we have about 60 seconds left. I'll give you the last word. Should we be a bit more optimistic? Are you pretty pessimistic about the short and medium term?
You know, I think I'm pretty much in line with my fellow participants today. I think, you know, short term, things are going to have to get worse before they get better. And that's partly because of the difficulty of making fundamental changes in the American political system. You know, I kind of look back to the Gilded Age in the early decades of the 20th century as being sort of the closest parallel in our history. When we had a very dysfunctional government, huge levels of economic inequality and so on. And, you know, it took decades of efforts and organizing at the state, local, and national level, but changes did occur. You know, there were progressive reforms, political reforms, as well as economic reforms, in some cases helped along by the Second World War. But at any rate, you know, change did come, but it didn't come quickly or easily. On the sort of positive side, you know, the marches that we saw after the 2016 Trump election, the Women's March on Washington and so on. I mean, these were the largest mass protest movements in American history, far overshadowing the anti-war movement of the 1960s and 70s. And then the Black Lives Movement, you know, after the George Floyd murder, you know, surpassed them. And so there is a engagement of the public and a concern that's expressed. Unfortunately, it takes these very sort of negative events to bring people out into the streets, to engage them electorally and so on. And so, so I don't have a particularly bright prognosis, but I am hopeful in the longer term that, you know, we'll respond positively to the challenges we face.
And what makes me the most optimistic is the fact that we're having these conversations, and because if democracy dies in darkness, at least we're shining some light, and hopefully these discourses will have a positive impact on the short, medium, and long-term future of a democracy. I want to thank all of you for joining us. Our guests today have been Jacob Hacker, Stanley Reeser Professor of Political Science at Yale University. He's the co-author of American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper, and a 2010 bestseller, Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. And his co-author is Paul Pearson. Segal Ben-Porath, a professor of education in the Education Division of the Graduate School at the University of Pennsylvania. She also holds a secondary appointment in the Department of Political Science and is the author of Free Speech on Campus and Citizenship Under Fire, Democratic Education in Times of Conflict. Martin Gillens,
chair of the Department of Public Policy and professor of public policy, political science, and social welfare at UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs. He's the author of Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America, and the co-author with Benjamin Page of Democracy in America, What Has Gone Wrong and What Can We Do About It? And Larry Bartels, the May Worthen Shane Chair of Public Policy and Social Science at Vanderbilt University. He's the co-director of the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. He's the co-author of Democracy for Realists, Why Elections Do Not Produce Responsive Government with Christopher Atchin, and Unequal Democracy, the Political Economy of the New Gilded Age. Thank you all very much for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.